This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. If you're a fan of a real Maine lobster roll, you know it's a splurge. $20 for a sandwich that comes in a hot dog roll? And yet, if you go to certain fast food chains in the summertime, you can get one for a pittance. How can that be? Well, probably because what you're eating at the cheaper place is not lobster at all, even if it says it is. You're probably also not using real extra virgin olive oil, though the bottle at the store might tell you otherwise. And that delicious red snapper you had at the restaurant the other night? That was almost certainly not red snapper. Larry Olmsted details these and other shenanigans in his new book, Real Food, Fake Food, Why You Don't Know What You're Eating and What You Can Do About It. He lives in Heartland and joins us today from our Norwich studio. Larry, nice to have you on the program.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
When you say that consumers are eating a lot of fake food, you don't mean like highly processed food, like fake as in not natural. You're actually talking about things like the lobster that's not lobster, or tuna in your sushi that's not tuna, or Parmesan cheese that may not actually even be all cheese. And this is, for the most part, completely legal?
Well, there's various degrees of fakeness, and some of them are legal and some of them are not. There are a lot of legal substitutions. So in the lobster example, there are cases where you get a lobster roll or lobster bisque or lobster ravioli with no lobster and it's legal. But in some of the cases, it's adulterated with something that's not supposed to be in there and it's not legal.
So give us a few more examples and why you could be eating something that says lobster roll but is not really lobster.
Well, for reasons that are unclear to everyone except the FDA. The FDA approved the use of langostino, which is a member of the hermit crab family, as lobster, which sort of opened up the floodgates for the fast food industry to start selling lobster quesadillas and lobster tacos and all sorts of low-priced lobster product that can contain some or no actual lobster. But when Inside Edition investigated this and actually tested some of the food, a lot of it didn't even have the langostino, which is the legal excuse for lobster. Some of it actually didn't even have any seafood at all. So there's varying degrees of how fake the lobster is and whether it's illegal or not.
And in my Parmesan cheese, what might I also be consuming? Fiber.
Well, there was a big scandal earlier this year, Parmesan Gate, started by Bloomberg News when they investigated this, and it was quickly dubbed wood pulp. I think that's a little bit sensational. It's a cellulose, which is a plant-based fiber. It certainly isn't milk. It certainly shouldn't be in your cheese, but it's not like you're adding sawdust. And that is only a problem in grated cheese. It's supposed to keep it from clumping, and the amount you need to add to keep it from clumping is somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 to 4%, but some of the samples tested were as high as 20% cellulose. But the bigger problem is that we make Parmesan cheese in this country at all. It's Parmesan cheese is named for Parma. To me, it's a product like champagne that's geographically designated, should only come from one place where it's made under certain rules, and our Parmesan cheese does not approach the quality of those rules. It's much less pure. You don't know what's in it. It's sometimes barely even defined as cheese.
Well, and explain why that is then, that producers in the U.S. are allowed to put on their label Parmesan and say to a consumer, this is Parmesan cheese. And, you know, we all know, we think we know sort of what we're getting, maybe, although you say that you think consumers are duped, when there is this designation where only Parmesan cheese that comes from Parma is real Parmesan. And in other parts of the world, it wouldn't be able to be sold as Parmesan if it wasn't from there. And yet in the U.S., we can have, you know, this grated, powdered stuff that says it's Parmesan.
And it's not just the grated stuff. It's a wedge of Parmesan cheese that's made in Wisconsin or made in Argentina and sold in the fancy cheese case right next to the wedge from Italy, and often for more money than the Italian stuff costs. So it's not just a matter of cheap imitations. The world has a long and rich history of what are called geographically indicated foods. A champagne would be the best known example. You ask almost anybody what's champagne and they're going to say, oh, it's a sparkling wine that can only be made in the Champagne region of France. Everybody knows that, except that's not really true. It's completely legal to make a product labeled champagne in the United States, and a lot of producers do in California and upstate New York. And it's almost never good wineries. Good wineries just call their California sparkling wine. It's used by lower quality products whose sort of best option is to try to confuse consumers. But the U.S. has a long history of refusing to participate in the trademark recognition of these products, even with our oldest allies, France and Italy, and even though almost all of these foods predate the existence of our country. So things we think of as coming from a particular place, like Parmesan cheese, champagne, Burgundy wine, Kobe beef from Japan, all routinely sold here with cheaper domestic versions.
We're talking today about food and fake food. Do you know if your orange juice is really pure orange juice? Do you trust that your ground coffee is 100% coffee beans? And have you ever tasted that powdered Parmesan cheese and thought it had a little bit of a woody flavor? All right, maybe not sawdust, but it has other stuff in it potentially. Not that the label will tell you that necessarily. We're talking with local writer Larry Olmsted, author of the new book, Real Food, Fake Food. And you can give us a call with your questions. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. How do you make sure as a consumer that you know what you're eating? You can also post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Larry, I promise we're going to talk to you a little bit about some of the things that you can do as a consumer to make sure that you are able to trust as much as you can what you're getting or to know what you're getting. But I want to talk about a few other examples as well. And you say that seafood is a particularly bad area when it comes to fakery. Give us a few examples.
Well, in the seafood industry, there's a problem called species substitution that's very widespread, where you order one type of fish of a perceived value and you get a different fish altogether. And this is fairly unique to the seafood industry, because if you go in and you order a T-bone steak at a restaurant, you might not be getting what you think if you're buying a grass-fed steak or some kind of special steak, but at least you can tell it's beef. That's not the case with seafood, where you order one kind of fish and get something completely different. And the primary example would be red snapper. It's the most widely substituted fish in the United States. Some studies, 94% of the time you order it at retail or in restaurants, you don't get red snapper or any kind of snapper. And the most common substitute for red snapper is a fish called tilefish, which is so high in mercury it's on the FDA's do not eat list for pregnant women and sensitive diners. So you go to buy this fish that's known to be delicious and popular, and you get something altogether different that is not only inferior but dangerous. And the problem is so widespread that a lot of people have never even tried red snapper.
Why is that legal? Why can somebody sell me red snapper if it's not red snapper?
It is not legal, but the seafood industry has been sort of rife with fraud for years. It's widely known. And there's just and in a lot of these categories, not just seafood, there's just a lack of enforcement. 91% of the seafood we consume in this country is imported, and the FDA is mandated by Congress to inspect only 2% of that. And every year they fall woefully short of that mandate. So they have a very, very low bar. They can't even begin to approach it. They inspect about 0.5% or 1/4 of what they're supposed to. And so it's very, very easy to swap these fish around. The average piece of fish passes through something like 8 middlemen and travels thousands of miles between the time it's caught and the time it arrives on your plate. And a lot of times we don't even know what country it came from.
And another culprit here is if you're ordering sushi and you think you're getting tuna, you're probably not getting tuna.
Right, especially the white tuna that's used, because some forms of tuna, the pinker tunas, bluefin tuna, if you had a steak, it's somewhat recognizable, like salmon. It has a real color to it. But in rolls, especially spicy tuna where it's chopped up, a lot of sushi now is eaten in rolls. That didn't used to be the case before sushi became really popular. So it's very easy to substitute fish it's easy to substitute anything anytime. It's harder to look at and tell what it is, which means when it's chopped up and added to something. So the number one tuna is the most substituted fish in sushi restaurants, and the number one substitute for tuna is a fish called escalar, whose nickname in the industry is the X-lax fish. And I won't go into great detail about that, but a lot of people eat sushi and maybe they don't feel so well the next day and they say, oh, I must have had bad tuna. But the reality is they did not have tuna at all.
Well, and this is where it comes into when it can be dangerous to be eating food that is mislabeled or misleadingly labeled. You mentioned the other fish that's often substituted for red snapper that can be really high in mercury. It's on the list if you're pregnant that you shouldn't be eating it. you can eat your sushi and think, oh, I don't feel so great. It's probably bad sushi, but it might just be the fish. And then there are cases where there really are things with either neurotoxins or that people who have food allergies are trying to avoid. And there's no real way for them to avoid them if they're looking at the labels and what the product actually is different than what it says it is.
And that's absolutely true. And as it seems that, you know, people have more allergies than they used to, so it's becoming more of an issue. Peanut oil has been used, as many other oils have, to cut olive oil. And if you were deathly allergic to peanuts, you would never remotely suspect that there would be a peanut product in your 100% pure olive oil. And with the seafood, the problem is so much of our seafood is produced in farms in Southeast Asia under really dubious conditions. Like I said, a lot of times the food, the fish can't even be traced back to a particular country. But when it's inspected, it's a number of times been found to contain antibiotics that are banned in this country or banned from our food supply because they're known carcinogens. So it's a real problem.
One of the things that you say in the book is that when it comes to fish, ironically, because in many cases you're better off going with a foreign product, but when it comes to fish, you're better off buying fish that is U.S. fish.
Absolutely. I mean, we have a great domestic fish industry. The problem is our fish is so good we export most of it because it's worth more to do it that way. So Alaska would be the prime example. Alaska is the only state in the country with sustainability built into its state constitution, and aquaculture is outlawed in Alaska. So every single piece of seafood originating in Alaska is wild caught, and they're best known for salmon. The water is clean. The fish and the water are tested fairly regularly. They're always low in heavy metals and things that accumulate in the water compared to farmed fish. And wild-caught shrimp from the Gulf of Mexico. 75% of the shrimp produced domestically come from the Gulf of Mexico. They're delicious. They're sweet. But because they command a high market value, again, we sell most of them abroad and import much cheaper farm shrimp from Southeast Asia that, in addition to having health problems, also have been linked to slave labor and really widespread environmental destruction. Farm shrimp is probably the worst seafood choice you could make.
And in fact, you don't eat as much shrimp anymore because you're not always sure.
I don't. And not only am I not always sure, but it just doesn't taste as good when you have this kind of shrimp. And I remember when I was growing up, shrimp was considered sort of a luxury item like lobster. You'd have it when you went out for a kind of a special occasion meal or you go to a fancy steakhouse and shrimp cocktail was the big appetizer to have. There was never a notion that you should be eating $9.99 all-you-can-eat popcorn shrimp. That is directly an effect of the farming and mass production, which in turn has really driven down the quality.
We're talking with Larry Olmsted. He's the author of the new book, Real Food, Fake Food, Why You Don't Know What You're Eating and What You Can Do About It. If you have a question for him, call 1-800-639-2211 or post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Catherine writes, so I know about the real extra virgin olive oil scandals from abroad, inferior, old, rancid, and not 100%. And she says, I've switched to products from California. Am I any better off?
Generally, yes. I say in my book that, you know, there's a lot of different ways to shop for olive oil. There are some labeling things you can look for. It's kind of complicated. But if all you have to go on is geography, I would buy olive oil from Australia, from Chile, and from California would be my top three. And with California, it's a little bit easier because it's more widely available. But the better producers have formed a thing called the California Olive Oil Council's 100% Certified Extra Virgin. And the people who get this seal send their samples out for laboratory analysis. And if you're buying from California, you should be looking for that seal on the bottle. And it's pretty reliable.
Is it going to cost you more?
It's cost more than the cheap supermarket olive oil, but it's not dramatically expensive. The thing about olive oil is that they're sort of fraud at all levels. So you can go into a gourmet store and buy a $35 bottle and it's fake. And you can go into the supermarket and buy a bottle from California that's $12 and it's real. It's still going to be more than maybe the $5 olive oil. But in America, we consume an average of one bottle per person per year. And when you compare it to, you know, say wine, even if you spend $35 on a bottle of olive oil and you use one bottle a year, it's well worth it. It's healthier. It tastes much better.
Well, go into the taste because you describe this in great detail, loving detail in the book. And you say that most of us, even if we think we're getting pretty good olive oil, we don't really know what really good olive oil tastes like.
I think that that is absolutely true. And, you know, my book has gotten a lot of reaction. People are scared. Oh, my God, there's all this stuff in the food. But I want to remind people that the reason I wrote it and the reason it's called Real Food, Fake Food is because these real foods are so good. And I look at it as a sort of a glass half empty, half full thing. Instead of thinking about it as I'm terrified to buy olive oil, you should think of it as olive oil is great. I want to make sure I buy the great stuff. Because it is so good. And I spoke to an instructor at the Culinary Institute of America who specializes in olive oil. And he, too, said, you know, a lot of Americans have just never tasted the good stuff. And when I open a bottle of the olive oil I buy at home, and I use more than a bottle a year, I have to say, my kitchen immediately smells like olives. The scent explodes out of the bottle. That does not happen with the supermarket version. It's greener. It's darker. It's just delicious. It's spicy. It's got peppers in it. You could literally drink it. And in Greece, where they consume the most olive oil in the world, they do drink it. And because it's that good. So I think people, there, if they've grown up on supermarket olive oil, they think, olive oil, what's the big deal? Why is this the sort of lifeblood of the Mediterranean basin and one of the most historically rich foods? But when you try the good stuff, you can't go back.
Yeah, you've even put it on ice cream. And you know, the cheap supermarket stuff, I'm not imagining is going to be my favorite topping for ice cream.
No.
If you have a question about food and how to identify what you're eating, our number is 1-800-639-2211. Bill's calling in from Brownsville. Hi, Bill. Go ahead.
Hi. I was wondering about cottonseed oil. I understand cotton is not a food crop, so it allows different fertilizers to be used.
Do you know anything about that, Larry?
I really don't. It's a pretty niche oil, but you bring up a good larger point, if I could address quickly, is that almost all of the oils we think of as food oils are known in the industry as seed oils. Sunflower seed, corn oil, corn is a seed, rapeseed oil, which more commonly called canola. The cottonseed, which you just mentioned, and all of these oils have to be chemically or thermically extracted to get out of the seed, which means they're basically distilled or they're leached out of the seed. Whereas olive oil is unusual in that it's a fruit oil, not a seed oil, and it's made the same way as you make fresh squeezed orange juice. Entirely mechanical crushing. You can either crush an olive or you can spin it in a centrifuge until you get the oil out of it, but that's it. There's no deodorization, bleaching, chemicals, distilling that destroy all the health properties. That's why olive oil has so much more health property than any of the seed oils, but it's also why it doesn't last very long and goes bad easily.
From 100% pure beef hot dogs that are not, in fact, 100% beef at all, to honey that may not be what you think it is. We're talking about fake food. Coming back in just a moment with Larry Olmsted, the author of the new book, Real Food, Fake Food. And we're going to talk more about how do you identify real food? How do you make sure that you're getting what you think you are? And why should you care? 1-800-639-2211 is our number, or you can post thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're talking with award-winning travel and food writer Larry Olmsted about his new book, Real Food, Fake Food. How closely do you monitor the information on the food you eat? Do you know if your Gruyere cheese is real Gruyere or just a cheap imitation? And does it matter? Olmsted argues it does. Consumers are being duped, and legitimate producers, especially foreign ones, are having their livelihoods significantly affected. Even more alarming is when potentially dangerous substances are added to foods and not disclosed. We're talking about all of it, and if you have a question or a thought you'd like to share, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Karen writes in to say, as a Vermonter, I feel incredibly lucky to have access to good quality food all the time. Knowing the farmers who grow, raise, and make my food is such a privilege. Some argue the prohibitive costs, but Whole Foods from people I know is worth other sacrifices. Is Karen on the right track, Larry?
I think she is 100% on the right track. I feel the same way. I've made it a personal effort to eat more drug-free meat, whether that's beef or pork or seafood or chicken. And to buy, you know, really, I love beef, and to buy really good 100% grass-fed, drug-free, no animal byproduct beef certainly costs more than supermarket beef. So I eat beef less, but I eat better beef. And I think that's the kind of sacrifice that makes sense. I think she's on the right track. And I think she also brings up a great point about living in Vermont. You know, I can buy, I can and have bought my beef and pork directly from the farmer, have a freezer full of it. It's a little bit easier here where we live. But it also brings up the issue, you know, we're very proud in this state of some of the products we produce, that probably the, you know, obviously cheese, but the most famous would be maple syrup. And I wonder how producers here in Vermont would feel if, you know, say all over Europe and the rest of the world, they were selling something in the same jug that said Vermont maple syrup that was had no connection to Vermont or maple syrup, which is basically what we do with all the other countries' products.
Yeah, talk a little bit about that, because there are protections in many countries for country of origin or even smaller regions of origin for things that we know well. You mentioned champagne. That's one I think almost everybody knows, that champagne has to be produced in this very specific region in France. Tequila is another one. You talk about port. You talk about certain types of wines and certain types of cheese, like Parmesan, that are protected in many countries, but not in the United States. That protection often doesn't extend to us here when these things are considered generic.
Right. And it's kind of funny what we consider generic, but the Treaty of Versailles in the 1800s was when they first protected champagne. It's sort of the oldest product to get this international trademark protection. And the U.S. Agreed to sign the treaty and then changed their mind. And then again, that was the Treaty of Madrid. And then the Treaty of Versailles was after the World War. Again, we did sign, but then the Senate didn't ratify it. And we've always been sort of the international outlier in the first world. I just saw a map of countries that do not respect the champagne trademark. And there's four of them in the world. And there's us and China and a couple of small countries, which is really telling. The cheese thing, I mean, there's dozens and dozens of European cheeses that are specific to a place. And it's not just specific to a place, but in each case, they can only be made one way from one kind of ingredient. So they're very pure in the sense that when you buy real Gruyere cheese or a real Roquefort cheese, you know exactly what you're getting, including the fact that it's made from drug-free milk. And we make knockoffs of all these kinds of cheeses, Manchego, and most other countries. People don't realize the U.S. is the largest cheese producer in the world. We produce a third of the world's cheeses. You know, cheeses are associated with Europe, but we're number one when it comes to cheese, and we try to export a lot of these cheeses. And increasingly, countries are wising up, and I mean, everybody from Costa Rica to Korea has banned a lot of our cheese exports. We just signed a big trade pact with China to try to move a lot of our cheese over there, and I think that kind of reflects the situation.
Well, you do describe, again, in great detail and with a lot of affection, some of the practices that go into making some of these real food products, especially ones in other countries, like really good Swiss cheese. And it's a defense of why the real thing should get its due, why we should pay the premium that might go along with it. These cheeses, for example, are often just, you know, it's incredible work that goes into making them. But many people might say, look, you know, that thing that says Swiss cheese that I get at the deli counter and I put it on my sandwiches is fine. I know what it means when it says Swiss cheese and I like it. It may not be premium, but that's fine. That's all I want. And I'm happy with it. So why care about the details?
Well, again, it's just like the olive oil. It's a reflection that you've never tried the real thing. So, and in many cases, our perception of what a product is based on the fake. So when you say Swiss cheese at the deli, that doesn't really taste anything. I mean, in Switzerland, they don't have anything called Swiss cheese. They have Gruyere. But the Swiss cheese you buy at the deli is like its own food category that's been made up. And it's the same way for a lot of the foods we eat in this country. People – you know, I talk about truffle oil, which is an entirely fake manufacturing. There's no such thing as real truffle oil.
They don't chop up. It's synthetic, you say.
It's synthetic. Yeah, they don't chop up truffles and put it in oil the way you might basil. It's just a laboratory experiment. It has nothing to do with truffles. Has no truffle in it. But it's so widely used in restaurants in this country that Americans' perception of the taste of truffle is not related to the truffle. It's related to this derivative of formaldehyde. So and it's the same for a lot of the cheeses. It's the same for the olive oil. If you actually tasted what these products tasted like, and again, here in Vermont, we have fantastic cheeses. And when you look around the state at these great companies, Jasper Hill and all the artisanal cheesemakers here, none of them are making Parmesan cheese. None of them are making Gruyere. They're making things with names like Constant Bliss. That they created a product and they're proud of it and they're branding it. They're not trying to ride someone else's reputation.
Let's go to Janet, who's calling in from Ferrisburg. Hi, Janet. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks. Could you speak to, in the fishing industry outside the U.S., I've heard that people get kidnapped or duped into slavery in a lot of the fishing, fish production in other countries, and I'm curious about that. I'm also curious about honey laundering, and I've decided to buy only honey from Vermont.
Janet, thanks for the call. Larry, you do write about slavery in particular in the shrimping industry, but Janet's questions are about fishing in general.
Right. It's been most widely associated with Thailand and with the shrimp farm industry. I would not be surprised if there are other instances of it, especially because a lot of the industrial fishing ships are basically a kind of captive audience, if you might say. They leave port for a long time. You're on it. You're working. You can't get off. But the well-documented issues of slave labor in seafood are mostly revolved around Thai shrimp farms. And that's important because Thailand is our number one supplier of shrimp, and shrimp is the most widely eaten seafood in the United States. So that's a big issue. Then as far as honey, is typically in the top five. I think right now it's number three on the Michigan State Food Fraud Initiative's list of most adulterated foods in the world. So honey is fraught with danger. And you're absolutely right to be buying it locally. And I don't say that. I know a lot of people support local agriculture or worry about carbon footprint. That's not what I mean in this case of honey. It's that most of the cases of honey adulteration, and there are a lot, have to do with imported honey. And honey that is then rebranded as a product of someplace else and distributed sort of generically large faceless brands. So when you can buy honey locally, you know where it comes from. And the beauty of honey is that it's produced almost everywhere. Even in New York City, they make honey. So you can – wherever you live in the country, you can buy local honey.
And it's adulterated with things like corn syrup?
That's a best case scenario. the largest documented food fraud case that was ever prosecuted in the history of the United States was honey, and involved Chinese honey, because Chinese honey is frequently banned. The FDA issues these import orders against different products from different countries from time to time. So Chinese honey was banned in the United States because it was found to contain an antibiotic that was a known carcinogen that was banned in our food supply. So all of this ring, I mean, it's very similar to a drug ring. It's organized criminals took Chinese honey, shipped it to other countries like Malaysia, relabeled it, product of whatever country they shipped it through, shipped it to the U.S. and sold it to supermarkets for 7 years, $80 million worth of honey. And when it was tested, it was both cut with corn sugar to extend it and make it cheaper and contained these dangerous drugs. And when they interviewed one of the Chinese laborers involved in packaging it, he said that it smelled and tasted like sauerkraut. So probably not the honey you want.
Mm. We got a note from Michael who wants to know if you could say what sources you use to do all of your great research for this book.
Oh, that is a good question. Took me about 4 years, this project, and if you buy the book, you will see that it is very, very heavily footnoted. So there's no one source. I mean, I interviewed scientists. I interviewed government officials. I interviewed representative nonprofits. I rely a lot on existing research, scientific documents, other newspaper investigations, particularly, say, in the realm of seafood fraud. It's something that's often tackled locally. The Boston Globe will do expose on seafood in New England, and someone else will do one in Florida, and I kind of piece those together.
One thing you do not have in terms of research in your book, in terms of interviews, is a great deal of first-person interviews with the FDA. In fact, you only have one, and it's from somebody who decided that he had to remain anonymous. And you really blast the FDA in your book about not doing what it's supposed to be doing.
Oh, they have a huge media affairs office, and I contacted them repeatedly. They told me they would get people in touch with me. I offered to come to D.C. repeatedly. I do it by phone, do it in person, do whatever they wanted. And in the long run, they were unable to produce anyone except this one anonymous source.
So, you know, bottom line here, Larry, what do you do if you live in, say, rural Vermont? Your small local grocery store is likely chock full of fakes. You don't have the budget to be buying online from boutique stores. What do you do to try to make sure that you're doing the best you can for yourself and your family and for producers?
Well, you buy, I guess if you live in a rural area, you buy as much as you can from farmers. But in general, there's no catch-all solution, but I just recommend always buying closest to the original form of the food. So if you buy, if you know what red snapper looks like and you buy a whole fish, you won't be ripped off. If you buy coffee beans that aren't ground already, you're less likely to be ripped off. So just buy your food as whole as possible.
Buy the whole lobster and break it apart yourself. Don't buy the lobster roll.
Exactly.
Larry Olmsted is the author of the great new book, Real Food, Fake Food, Why You Don't Know What You're Eating and What You Can Do About It. It will make you both simultaneously less hungry and more hungry because he describes these really wonderful foods and all of the places that he travels to explore how they're made. Larry, thank you so much for sharing your insight with us.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, presumptive Green Party presidential nominee Jill Stein is coming to Vermont tomorrow, hoping to convince disaffected voters that she's the candidate they should be backing. We'll talk with Dr. Stein next on Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. On Tuesday, Bernie Sanders joined Hillary Clinton at a rally in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and formally endorsed her candidacy for the presidency, saying he would do whatever he could to make sure the Democrat gets elected. A day later, the presumptive Green Party candidate, Jill Stein, announced she is going to be speaking in Vermont this Friday. Dr. Stein joins us now to talk about why she's running for president and why she's making a pitch to win over Bernie Sanders supporters. Dr. Stein, welcome to the program.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
So you are coming to Bernie country tomorrow, just days after he formally endorsed Hillary Clinton. What are you hoping to achieve?
Well, I'm hoping to keep the movement going and to ensure people that their hard work and the amazing transformation of the political landscape that they've accomplished over the past year, that will go on. As Bernie himself said, it's a movement, not a man. And many people from Bernie's campaign are making the decision not to go back into the Democratic Party, not to support specifically a candidate, that is Hillary Clinton, who represents very much the opposite of what this campaign, Bernie's campaign, has been working for. And to let people know that my campaign is here, we've been here from the start as kind of a plan B for Bernie, and I think what happened to Bernie, the sabotage of his campaign by the Democratic Party speaks volumes about the party. The fact that you really can't have a revolutionary campaign inside of a counter-revolutionary party. So my campaign is here. It's going strong with very much of the same agenda that Bernie represented.
You, in fact, I believe, said you would drop your candidacy if Bernie Sanders wanted to come over to the Green Party and run as the Green Party candidate. Are you disappointed that he has endorsed Clinton and you say not spoken at all formally with the Green Party?
Well, you know, I think it's been pretty clear for a long time that Bernie intended to stay within the Democratic Party. He said that from the very start. And my campaign, actually the Green Party, has been working to contact Senator Sanders for many years, actually starting in the last campaign in 2012. And, you know, he's not been interested. That's not his work. That's not how he sees his work. So, you know, my hope was that the experience of the last month, where he really experienced up close and personal the very underhanded tactics of the Democratic Party that sought to silence him, that stripped voter rolls in Brooklyn, that failed to count the votes in California, that manipulated the convention in Nevada, and that had superdelegates and Super Tuesdays from the start, really tipping the playing field against grassroots politics. politics. My hope was that with Senator Sanders being on the personal receiving end of that very unfair and underhanded system, that maybe he would change his thinking. But, you know, for reasons I can understand, he's going to stay the course inside of the Democratic Party, and he'll be very useful in his role in the Senate. But I think many of his supporters who are of a different generation, who've really experienced the Democratic Party not as the party of the New Deal, but rather the party of expanding war, the party of Wall Street bailouts, the party of all of the above, which has been a disaster for the climate, that many of these people, you know, aren't going to give up on what they've done. And Cornel West just came out and endorsed my campaign, saying that it's a race to the bottom between the greater and lesser evils, that we need to stand up. And, you know, I think it's the millennial generation that's been leading the way in Bernie's campaign, and many of them, I think, will continue leading the way to a very different political future within my campaign.
There have been reports that you've seen an uptick in donations since Sanders endorsed Clinton. Can you clarify the numbers of what you're seeing in terms of donations to your presidential campaign?
Yes. It's been a massive sea change. And frankly, we didn't exactly expect it. The first sign was that our social media began to blow up. And we went from like 8,000 new Facebook likes in a week to what's now over 50,000 new additions in the course of just a couple days. And our donations have gone up approximately by a factor of 10, with just tens of thousands of new people coming in, donating the characteristic $27 donation, which is really sort of the symbol of the Bernie movement. That's what's pouring into our campaign, thousands of $27 donations. So it's very clear that this movement is going strong, and I think it's not going to give up. And the other thing I should mention, there are, you know, 42 million young people who are locked into predatory student loan debt, and that's young people, and now it's people well into middle age as well, because you just can't get out of that debt in the economy that we have. And it's important for people to realize 42 million people who have only one place to turn, I'm the only candidate who will cancel that debt like we did for the crooks on Wall Street. I say it's time to bail out the students who are the victims of that waste, fraud, and abuse on Wall Street. So if those 42 million people in debt decided to come out and effectively cancel their debt by voting for me, they would effectively do that, because 42 million is a winning plurality of the vote in a three-way race. So I'm coming to Vermont, you know, basically to thank people for having gotten this incredible movement going, and to encourage people that this movement is not over, it's going strong, and let's stick together and let's take back this future that belongs to us, that they have begun to transform. We can continue that work.
Jill Steinitz running for president as a Green Party candidate. The Green Party has not held its nominating convention yet. That'll happen in early August, but she is the presumptive nominee. You just were talking, Dr. Stein, about student loan debt, and that being one of the things that you were running on, this idea of helping Americans get out of their debt from student loans. Can you describe a couple of the other tenets of your platform?
Sure. So we're calling, actually, similarly to Bernie, you know, we're saying this is an economic emergency where the economy is working for the very few. It's still an emergency for most people, in spite of the rhetoric out there that tells us we're in a recovery. For most people, it's not a recovery. We're calling for an emergency jobs program, which will actually solve, at the same time, the emergency of climate change. So in fact, we call for 20 million good wage jobs that transition us on an emergency basis to green energy, a green food system, like I heard you discussing as I was waiting for this call, a local and sustainable food system, a healthy organic food system, as well as a healthy green energy system, and a system of public transportation. And we're calling for 100% clean renewable energy by 2030. That is wind, water, and sun. That's enough time to save us from the climate crisis as we revive the economy. We call for health care as a human right. Also, in the way that Vermont has been leading the charge, we're calling for a national single-payer system through an improved Medicare for all. We call for an end, as I mentioned, to student debt, but also to police violence, and a welcoming path to citizenship, and an end to the war on drugs. And finally, I should mention, we call for a foreign policy that's based on international law and human rights rather than on economic and military domination, which has been such a catastrophe, costs us over half of our discretionary budget, approximately half of the income tax that every American is paying is going to basically the war machine. This is a crazy system. It doesn't make us more safe. It makes us less safe. So by changing to a foreign policy based on international law and human rights, we can save an enormous amount of money and put those resources into building true security here at home.
I know this is a question that third-party candidates always face with some frustration, but it is the big critique given the way our system currently works. Are you worried that you'll be a spoiler in this election and take votes from the Democrats and hand the presidency to Donald Trump?
So let me say first, what I intend to do is not split the vote, but flip the vote, so that we who are the underdog become the top dog, that is, the everyday American who's really being thrown under the bus. We actually have that power. This concept of splitting the vote depends on thinking we are tiny. It's actually really important to realize how powerful we are. In the words of Alice Walker, the biggest way people give up power is by not knowing we have it to start with. 42 million people in debt is enough to win the election. And the bottom line is, we have to lead the way forward. The politics of fear actually delivered everything we were afraid of. All the reasons you were told to vote for the lesser evil is exactly what we've gotten. So we say, forget the lesser evil, fight for the greater good, like our lives depend on it, because they do. We have the power to turn this around.
Jill Stein is running for president on the Green Party platform. The Green Party will hold its official nominating convention in early August. She'll be speaking in Burlington tomorrow evening at 7 at the McClure Multigenerational Center. Thanks very much for taking the time to talk with us.
Great talking with you. Thanks so much.
On Monday, we had a vigorous debate over the possibility that Rutland might be listed as a city where refugees can be resettled, specifically 100 refugees from Syria. The debate in Rutland has taken two forms. One point of contention is whether Rutland residents want to bring in refugees from the Syrian conflict. That debate includes questions about resources and the capacity to support their resettlement. The other point of disagreement is how the idea was developed. We heard accusations that Mayor Christopher Loris made the plan in secret to avoid public opposition to resettling refugees in Rutland. Many of you have weighed in with strong feelings, and our executive producer, Patty Daniels, joins me now to share some of your comments. Hi, Patty.
Hi, Jane. So we'll start just pointing out the question of who knew what when. The Board of Aldermen has said it was kept in the dark and that it had unanswered questions about what resettling refugees would mean for city resources. Mayor Loris said on the program that he's given the board an abstract of the proposal that his office made to the U.S. Department of State that does answer these questions.
But right after our discussion ended, we got a message from Rutland Alderwoman Sharon Davis. She writes, "Please be aware the Board of Aldermen has never received the abstract. It was requested by Alderman Scott Tomola. We were given, as an example, one from Utah. We have asked for the current abstract and have not received it."
More listeners wrote us in favor of resettling refugees in Rutland than against. Here's a sampling of both that touch on the ideas espoused by a group called Rutland First, which is critical of the plan, and by another group called Rutland Welcomes, which supports it. And we'll start with Dale, who says, Rutland First may be characterizing their objections to the refugees as being about process, but their ultimate goal is simply to scuttle the plan. Despite this vocal minority, there are many more Rutlanders who feel proud that Mayor Loris has reached out. And Dale goes on, as a city and a community, we need to not wait for some utopian moment when all problems magically disappear before we act with compassion. We need to do the right thing.
But Heather says, why can't Rutland Welcomes help the desperate need we have with our own citizens? They should be ashamed that they come out to help foreigners yet neglect their own neighbors.
David says, 35 years ago, we brought a dozen Cambodian refugees to St. Johnsbury. There were no huge problems created over the years, and the kids graduated from the academy here and then drifted off to other parts of the country. America is the big kid on the block, and President George Bush destabilized that part of the world. The very least we can do is to accept a few refugees. We owe the world that much.
And Kristen says, Rutland has a population of about 16,500. 100 people are not going to tax our current social services to the point of eliminating services for our current population.
But Sean wonders, would the mayor consider his tenure a success? And is this move more of a personal legacy than what's really in the best interest of Rutland?
We also have an audio response from Nora in Grantham, New Hampshire. She described Syrian refugees as entrepreneurial, skilled, and educated, and says they will be an asset to the community here.
Last week, I concluded my second trip this year to Jordan, and in working with Syrian refugees, they always ask me, why do Americans hate us? And I always respond, they haven't met you yet.
Well, we always appreciate your comments, written, recorded, or otherwise. We're on social media at Vermont Edition, or drop an email to vermontedition@vpr.net.
Thanks, Patty.
You're welcome.
All right, it's perfect weather to get out and play a round of golf, minus the thunderstorms, but the number of golfers in Vermont is dropping, and one Chittenden County Country Club is considering a deal that would see it give up 9 holes of the course to build new housing. Tomorrow, we'll look at the state of golf in Vermont. You can share your thoughts with us at vermontedition@vpr.net and listen to the program tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone, with production assistance from Jake Burstein. Liam Connors directed the show, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.